But my expenses were heavy and it was not my practice to charge more for my sittings than even the poorest could afford. Also, my old fear of being out of work still gnawed at me and I tried to save as much as I could against that evil day. So I shook my head and said, "I just can't afford it." "I'll chip in a few quid," said Owen cheerfully. Sheer human decency can always bring the tears to my eyes and I had to swallow very hard. When Owen had left school a couple of years before, a friend of mine had kindly found him a place as a junior with one of the camera crews at the studios in Boreham Wood. Owen loved the work and he hoped one day to become a star lighting cameraman, just like Gunter Krampf or Jimmy Harvey. Owen earned very little but he contributed to the household budget and I knew he was secretly saving every penny he could spare to buy a motorbike he so badly wanted. Yet here he was offering to dip into his savings for me to buy a suit. "Don't be silly," I said gruffly. "Of course I can find the money for a suit if your mother thinks I need one." As soon as I said it I felt a familiar chill of fear, but then Edith said, "Don't worry, dear, I'll find a tailor who won't con you and I can easily cut down on the housekeeping." Edith could always make the sun come out again. It seems unbelievable now, but since our move to Hendon I had been so isolated in the ivory tower of my work, so wrapped up in a cocoon of domestic content, that I was only half aware of the man Hitler and the evil which was creeping over the face of Germany. I was measured for my suit in a room above a sweet shop in Golders Green, where for a few pounds Nathan Hirsch worked with the dedicated skill of a master craftsman. With the help of a dictionary, which he was using to try and better his English, Mr. Hirsch told me what was happening to his people in Germany. The days passed and by the time my new suit was finished Hitler's Ideresis Negation Elgri Automata were marching into Austria. England consoled herself with eyewitness accounts in the newspapers which described tanks made of cardboard, guns without bullets, planes unable to leave the ground, and ill-clad teenage soldiers. We breathed again. Hitler was not ready, there would be no war. One day, during the summer which followed the rape of Austria, John James was about to leave after one of his regular sittings when he said casually, "Would it be convenient for you to call at Kensington Palace next Thursday at 3 o'clock? I gaped at him stupidly. He explained that Princess Louise wanted to meet me and since she was shortly leaving London, the following Thursday would suit her admirably. My appointment book was crammed but I had a vague idea that royal invitations were tantamount to commands, which gave me visions of time in a dungeon in the Tower of London if I refused. Still currently reading, Voices in the Dark, My Life as a Medium. I would just have to rearrange my appointments somehow." I said Thursday would suit me fine. Looking spruce in Mr. Hirsch's navy pinstripe suit, the cut of which I thought even a princess of royal blood would approve, I emerged from the underground station at Hyde Park Corner on the big day to find that, in my nervous anxiety to be punctual, I had left myself an hour for the 15-minute bus journey to Kensington. I decided to stroll through the park to the palace. It was a glorious afternoon and halfway to my destination I sat down on a bench to feast my eyes on a scarlet blaze of geraniums and considered how unlikely and how absurd it was that I should be on my way to call on a royal princess in her palace. I wondered if her staff would look down their noses at me. I had never before met a butler, but I had a feeling they might be snotty and supercilious. I consoled myself with the thought of Mr. Hirsch's impeccable tailoring and dismissed them. Then a new thought disturbed me. Did one kiss the hand of a princess on being presented and if so how was it done? I had a sudden Ideresis Negation ash of an actor in some Ideresis Negation LM I had seen planting a kiss on a lady's palm then nibbling halfway up her arm, but I rejected this technique as inappropriate. Unhappily certain that if there were any pitfalls of etiquette into which I might stumble, I would be bound to do so, I proceeded on my way. My concerns were laid to rest when John James met me at the entrance of the palace and, as he conducted me into what he called the small drawing room, he gave me a few hints on to how to conduct myself towards my royal hostess. Compared to the sitting room at 31 Sydney Grove, the small drawing room of the palace did not look all that small to me. Her Royal Highness Princess Louise was sitting very upright on a chair with a high carved back when James ushered me into the room. The hand-kissing problem was settled right away when she held out her hand in a friendly way like any other hostess might do. When I had lightly touched hands with the princess, she waved me to a comfortable chair and invited James to also be seated. I took stock of my surroundings and absurdly enough I was reminded of the parlor of which my grandmother was so proud. This room was infinitely more rich and splendid, but the heavy furniture, the velvet curtains at the windows, the wealth of statuary and bric-a-brac and the pictures crowding the walls had the same fusty flavor of the room which was Gran's pride and joy. There was even the smell of wax polish. The fact was, of course, that both rooms reflected the taste of a bygone age and both belonged to elderly women to whom the past was more vivid to them than the present. The princess started the conversational ball rolling by asking if I had noticed the statue of Queen Victoria in her coronation robes outside the palace. She told me she had designed it herself and had it executed from a single piece of Carrara marble to mark the 50th year of the reign. Princess Louise had clearly been devoted to Queen Victoria, to whom she referred rather touchingly as Mama. With the ice duly broken, we talked easily together for an hour or more about my work and about the evidence in the messages James had conveyed to her from her mother and her husband the Duke. I remember the princess saying she no longer had the slightest fear of death and she looked on it as a kind of emigration to a new country, where she would rejoin those she had loved who had travelled there before her. She mentioned the difficulties she had sometimes encountered because of her royal birth and told me how she would often say to those who felt uncomfortable or inhibited in her presence that she could not help being a queen's daughter and they must try not to mind it. She talked most happily about her childhood at Windsor Castle and of the period she and her husband had spent in Canada while he was Governor General there. She was very proud of the fact that the Canadians had named their new province Alberta because it was one of her first names. Although the princess gave no outward sign of it, I got a strong impression after a while that she was suffering intense pain, and so when she suggested ringing for tea, I glanced questioningly at James. He shook his head slightly, and I excused myself and took my leave of a very gracious and gentle lady. When I got off the bus at Hyde Park Corner to get the tube train back to Hendon, my heart sank when I saw the news bills outside the underground station. Hitler was at it again. This time he was demanding the Sudetenland from the Czechs. On the train home, I thought back to my childhood in the aftermath of the war which was to end all wars. I recalled the men who came back crippled, shell-shocked, with the tissues of their lungs rotted by poison gas, waiting, patient and hopeless in the long queues for the dole. I prayed the senseless slaughter and squalor of war would not return. During this summer of mounting tension and anxiety over the Czech crisis, my work continued, but now there were more failures than usual. Those who guide me from the other side of life told us that the atmosphere surrounding the earth was so filled with fear and thoughts of war, that it was hard for those who live in the light to penetrate what appeared to them as a thick fog. There were successful seances of this time too, of course, and I have a letter dated June 4, 1970, from Mr. William A. Pritchard of 85 Bishopston Road, Swansea, to remind me of one of them. I do not think I can do better than to quote an extract from it here. "My one and only sitting with you took place over 30 years ago in the summer of 1938. My mother was with me. She was in this country on holiday from Rhodesia, where she and my father were then living. We made our booking by phone and no names were either requested or given. There were about 8 sitters and the voices came quite independently of any seance, trumpet, and all sitters had physical contact with someone during the evening. A voice addressed me. Voice, hello, I thought I would come and make myself known. Mr. Pritchard, very nice. But who are you? Voice, Dick. Mr. Pritchard, and where did we know each other? Voice, we were in the Air Force together in South Africa. Mr. Pritchard, how did you manage to get where you are? Voice, well, you know how it was. I was on my motorbike and I hit a brick wall. The next thing I knew I was here. Break. My memory went back some 12 years to the very short time I had spent in the South African Air Force. Among the apprentices was a youngster known to everyone as Bonzo. He was a pleasant but very slow-witted boy with a curious affliction, which meant his hands were sort of over-coordinated. Whatever he did with one hand, the other hand automatically did the same thing, unless Bonzo made a deidiosis negation night mental effort to stop it. The story of Bonzo's passing had been sent to me shortly after my return to England in 1929. It appears he had acquired a motorbike and was out for a spin and travelling up the stem of a T-junction. When he put out his right arm to indicate, his left arm went out in sympathy and Bonzo went straight into a brick wall ahead of him. The year after my sitting with you, in 1939, I went back to South Africa, and when in Pretoria I took a trip up to Roberts Heights, the headquarters of the South African Air Force. In the orderly room were a couple of sergeants who remembered me and also remembered Bonzo, but even they did not know his real name. We looked up the records and discovered it was Richard Lundin. Whenever I am asked what I consider to be the most evidential sentence I have received at a séance, I quote the 10 words: "We were in the Air Force together in South Africa," because no one in that room in your house had any idea my mother and I had any connection with South Africa, let alone the Air Force. For months after war broke out, Britain existed in the uneasy calm of what was called the phony war. It was a period of no man's land in time when we accustomed ourselves to the blackout and rationing and the infringements of personal liberty. So apparently normal was the surface of life that many began to hope the half-hearted hostilities would peter out altogether in a negotiated peace which they thought would be a victory for civilization. Meanwhile, factories, shipyards and arsenals worked full blast preparing for the real war to come. My first public direct voice séance in wartime was held at Rochester Square Temple in North London. The temple had a glass roof which had been coated with black paint to conform with the blackout regulations. I cannot tell how effective this may have been at night as seen from the air, but it certainly did not prevent daylight from flooding into the hall. However, I took my place on the platform inside a hastily improvised cabinet and hoped for the best. To quote from a report of this meeting published by Orr Austin, in spite of the adverse conditions, spirit voices were heard all over the hall although no microphones were used. Towards the end of this meeting, as I sat in my dark airless cabinet wondering how long I could last before I passed out from the heat and nervous exhaustion, I heard a woman's voice. She was speaking so near to my cabinet she seemed almost to be addressing herself personally to me. "I am Edith Cavell," said the voice. "I came to this side of life because I felt patriotism was not enough. Although I admire the man and the woman who is patriotic, at the same time we must realize there is a greater thing than that. You must love your brother, whether he be an enemy or not. Try to love and forgive, not to hate." The voice faded, but its message remained to help me to resolve a problem which had been giving me much anxious thought ever since the outbreak of war. I had so often listened to the voices from beyond the grave of men and women who had been cut off in the prime of their lives by sudden death. They had spoken of their confusion and distress and how they had to cling to the familiar earth because it was all they had ever known. I had heard their reproaches: "Why didn't I know? Why didn't someone tell me? I was a patriot and my country was at war for a cause I believed to be just." But when this dreamlike half-war turned into the real thing, the killing would begin in earnest, and like other young and deidiosis negation T-men I would be called to join the armed services. Yet after all I had heard from the other side, about the soul's bewilderment when it is thrust suddenly out of its physical body into the next plane of existence, how could I be responsible for sending any unprepared human spirit into eternity? I had a quick recollection of a scene which had taken place in my childhood during the unveiling of a 1914-18 war memorial. During the ceremony, a group of women converged on a man who was standing watching. The women jostled and pushed and shouted at him, and at last the man went away. When I asked my grandmother what the man had done wrong, she told me he had been a Kinchier during the war and these women had lost sons in the fighting. I felt sorry that the women's grief had turned to resentment against someone they thought was a shirker, but I also saw that perhaps it took a special kind of courage to swim against the tide of war. I only hoped I would find it myself, because then and there I made up my mind that when the time came to stand up and be counted, I would be a conscientious objector. I would say with Martin Luther, "Here I stand. I can do no other." Some weeks later I received a letter from a member of a wealthy spiritualist organization in America. The writer said he had attended one of my public seances in London and had subsequently sat with me privately at my home in Hendon. He described the evidence he had been given and said it had proved to him beyond doubt the survival after death of someone dear to him. Because he and his colleagues feared my mediumship might be lost to the world if I remained in England, they offered me sanctuary in their country for the duration of the war. My passage would be arranged and my livelihood would be guaranteed for as long as it was advisable for me to remain in the States. It may seem illogical that I, who had so firmly rejected the thought of taking up arms, should feel highly indignant that anyone should imagine I would leave England at this time, but that was exactly how I felt. As politely as I could, I refused this well-meant offer by return letter. Christmas came and the war was still in a state of uneasy stalemate. The three of us at Sydney Grove tried hard to pretend everything was just as it had always been. We ate the traditional Christmas food, we did the traditional Christmas things, and we took very special effort over the surprises we had planned for each other. Perhaps we tried too hard because there was no heart and no real joy in any of it. How could there be when we feared that just over the horizon in the coming year the storm which had been gathering so long must surely break? On New Year's Eve, Edith produced from its hiding place a bottle of sparkling wine to toast not only the new year, but a whole new decade. On the stroke of midnight, we raised our glasses and wished each other a happy new year and sang Auld Lang Syne. Edith's velvet contralto voice gave a new meaning and a deeper emotion to the words that we had sung, unthinkingly, so often in the past. Early in 1940, I gave a séance which not only produced some first-class evidence of survival after bodily death, but I think it was one of the most unusual sittings I have ever given, and it certainly provided me with some needed light relief. The sitter gave her name as Mrs. Bowering and she appeared to be somewhere in her late 60s. We went into the séance room and sat down without any preliminary chit-chat, and I turned out the light. Mickey spoke to the lady almost at once. "There's a man here who says his name is Fred and that you are his wife, Alice." "Yes," said Mrs. Bowering, "Fred is my husband. Can I talk to him?" Shortly, a man's voice spoke, and he and Mrs. Bowering had an intimate and personal conversation about their past together until suddenly he said, laughingly, "Fancy you taking the trouble to have my body taken out of its grave after all these years and having it cremated. I see you are wearing the ring you buried with me on your finger at this moment. I've met Bowering over here, you know, and we like each other very much. As a matter of fact, it amuses both of us that you have my ashes in one urn on the mantelpiece and his ashes in another." Mrs. Bowering then inquired if Mr. Bowering could speak to her, and soon the voice of another man greeted her. "You know, Alice," he said, "even though you've put Fred's urn and mine on the mantelpiece, we are not really there. We are here and we often come together to try and help you, as much as we can, but these ashes really have nothing to do with us anymore." To my astonishment, Mrs. Bowering then told both her late husbands that she had met a man named Wilson and was seriously considering marriage with him. She wanted to know if they would object to this. Both Fred and Mr. Bowering said they had no objection at all, and the only thing they wanted was for Alice's happiness. I found this story of the ashes of two husbands, in urns on the same mantelpiece, so hard to swallow that when the light was turned on again I asked the lady if it was true. She said it most certainly was true and told me what great trouble she had in getting permission to exhume Fred's body to have him cremated. In the days she had buried Fred, cremation had not been a usual method of disposal, and so she had buried him in the conventional way. But things had changed when her second husband's time had come, and so he was cremated, and the urn containing his ashes adorned her mantelpiece. After a while she had begun to feel Fred might feel slighted, being all alone in the cemetery, and so she had started her campaign to have him exhumed and cremated to be placed alongside the second Mr. Bowring. Now that she had finally achieved this, she felt much happier. She also confirmed that the ring she was wearing had lain in the grave on Fred's finger for many years. She was glad neither husband objected to a potential third marriage, because she found life on her own very lonely. After this sitting, I did not see this lady for a couple of years, so I assumed she had married her Mr. Wilson and was once again living happily as a married woman. As it turned out, I was wrong. Long afterwards, she returned for a sitting with me in her new role as Mrs. Wilson, and her first two husbands came to speak to her again. She spent the entire sitting berating both of them for not warning her that Mr. Wilson was not only a man of dirty habits, but he had no money and she was forced to support him. Her late husbands expressed regret that matters had turned out badly, but they pointed out the decision to marry Mr. Wilson had been her own and she must take responsibility for it. However, it was Mrs. Wilson's freely expressed view that they should have known in advance how her third husband would turn out and given her fair warning. Mrs. Wilson sat with me regularly until her death at the age of 80. She lived apart from Mr. Wilson for many years and he died before she did. Even now am I sometimes wonder which husband has the pleasure of her company on the other side and how Mr. Wilson fits into the picture. Princess Louise died early in December 1939 and John James had not been able to sit with me for his regular séances because he was very fully occupied. He was engaged in clearing the contents of the princess's apartments of nearly 100 rooms, under the direction of the Duke of Kent, to whom the contents of the palace had been left in her will. However, in late March 1940 Mr. James telephoned to arrange a sitting and I was happy to oblige. I think both James and I felt sad sitting together for the first time since the passing of the gentle princess. But if we did, it was not for long, because Princess Louise herself spoke to us and told us how happy she was to be free of pain and the infirmities of old age and to be reunited with those she loved. She thanked James for doing what she had asked about her wedding veil and her rings. Then after the sitting, James told me that the princess was referring to the fact that she had requested to be covered with her wedding veil and for her engagement and wedding rings to be put in the casket with her ashes. Before he left that day, James showed me with great pride a pair of monogrammed cufflinks which the Duke of Kent had given him for his help in clearing the princess's apartments at Kensington Palace. In April of that year, Germany invaded Norway and the war began in earnest. While the Allies were attempting to land forces in Norway to help the Norwegians and all of Britain waited breathlessly from one news bulletin to the next, Owen came home one evening and told his mother and me that he had volunteered for the Royal Air Force and had been passed medically IDIRSIS negation T for air crew. "When do you have to go?" asked Edith, trying hard to sound matter of fact. "When they are in trouble, they'll send for Mundin," quipped Owen. "I have to stay put until then." Even this respite comforted Edith. The evil day was not yet. When Owen lightly inquired which branch of the forces I proposed to favor with my presence, I told him I intended to register myself as a conscientious objector when my call-up papers came. I watched for the contempt I dreaded to see in this boy I loved as a brother. He quirked his eyebrow in a way which was especially his and said lightly, "Good for you. I simply don't have that kind of courage." In May and June we learned the new word Blitzkrieg, as the Nazi hammer blows crushed Holland, Belgium and France and forced the British out of Europe at Dunkirk, from where, by what seemed like a miracle at the time, most of our troops were brought home to fight another day. They were dangerous days, highly charged with emotion, and within myself I constantly questioned whether I could really stand back and let others do the fighting. I wanted to serve, I wanted to help. I thought the war was a just one, if any war could be considered just, but always I came back to the fact that I could not, I would not kill. Later that year, after the Battle of Britain had been fought and won in the skies over England, Owen was posted to an air IDIRSIS negation held near Cambridge to begin his training as a pilot. When Edith and I saw him off at the station, he was cheerful and full of confidence. "Relax, you too," he joked. "Any minute now, Mundin, the terror of the skies, will be on the job. As the train started to move, he leaned out of the carriage window and kissed Edith. I'll be back, old lady, he said gently. And we'll have a nice cup of tea, I said, and I do not think I have ever felt so inadequate in my life. At last the day came when I had to appear before a tribunal to state my case as a conscientious objector. I took the train to London and had to spend some time searching for the hall near Victoria Station where the court was sitting, with Judge Hargreaves as president. Eventually I found the place and I was ushered into an anteroom where a number of other kinchis were waiting to be seen. I sat down next to a young fellow with a fair straggly beard who at once produced a slim volume from his pocket and began to read from it with great concentration. I took the hint and held back the casual pleasantry I had been about to utter. When I looked around I saw that no one was talking to his neighbor, all the young men were sitting silent and withdrawn, each intent on his own thoughts, his own problem. We were being heard alphabetically, so it was not too long before the usher put his head around the door and called out Flint, Leslie. I followed him out of the room. As I walked down the hall to a table where the five members of the tribunal were sitting, I was surprised to see spectators in the hall. Whether they were the friends and relatives of the men being heard or merely inquisitive members of the public I do not know, but I could have very gladly done without them. I was glad to see the members of the tribunal were wearing ordinary clothes. I had had the confused idea they would all be wearing awe-inspiring robes and wigs. There was even a woman among them, with a reassuringly frivolous hat perched on her carefully waved hair. As it turned out, the lady with the daisies on her bonnet was the toughest nut of all of them. I stood in front of these five keepers of my conscience and I straightened my shoulders, determined not to look timid or ashamed. Answering leading questions, I agreed that I was Leslie Flint, 30 years of age and, as far as I knew, I was fit and healthy. I also affirmed that on grounds of conscience I was unable and unwilling to serve in the armed forces in the present state of emergency. Kindly tell the tribunal whether your scruples are of a political or a religious nature, Flint. Thus the president had opening the bowling. I replied that I absolutely refused to take human life on religious grounds. An elderly man with a heavy mustache asked me what church I belonged to. I am the resident medium of a Christian spiritualist church in Hendon, I said. The elderly man blew through his mustache, and he reminded me of a petulant walrus. Not a recognized denomination of the Christian church, he said in triumph. The president thought it would meet the case if I were described as a Christian pacifist. Then the walrus whispered into the ear of the man next to him so loudly I heard, "The fellow's a crank of some kind." A red-faced man inquired if I thought Christ was a pacifist. I said his teaching was filled with ideas of brotherly love and peace between men, and I quoted the words about turning the other cheek. The red-faced man asked me what good I thought it would do to turn the other cheek to Hitler. I agreed it might be disastrous but added that this fact did not alter my determination not to kill. The hat with the daisies now turned in my direction. If you saw a Nazi stormtrooper trying to rape a woman you loved, would you just stand back and do nothing? She rapped out. Oh, no. I thought, oh no, not that. Well? Persisted the daisy bonnet. I said I would defend the woman with all my strength whether I loved her or not, but I would not kill the stormtrooper. If you had a knife in your hand, would you use it? From the way she spoke, I thought she must have been to a very posh school when she was young. I said I would use the knife to try to stop the stormtrooper raping the lady, but not to kill him. The bonnet lady uttered a small chirp of outrage. A genuine pacifist would reason with him, she said. A vivid picture of my 5'3" sweetly reasoning with a 6-foot-tall stormtrooper who was mad with lust, intruded on my inner eye and I felt a perilous desire to laugh. You would knife a man, but you wouldn't put a bullet through him in battle. Is that your position, Flint? Demanded the man with the red face, returning to the fray. I looked at the faces confronting me, honest, upright members of society trying to be fair. Trying to understand, but not able to hide the growing suspicion I was a coward or a shirker. I asked the president if I could explain to the members of the tribunal the spiritualist philosophy on which I based my determination to go to prison, rather than join the armed forces. The walrus was heard to mutter that he did not want to listen to spook claptrap, he didn't believe in it, anyway. But the president told me to go ahead and please to be brief.